In the name of Allah, most gracious, most merciful, I praise Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and I send peace and blessings to all of the prophets, all of the righteous ones from the beginning of time, and especially to our beloved Prophet Muhammad, his family, his companions, and all those who call to his way and establish his sunnah to the day of judgment. As to what follows, I begin with the greeting words of the righteous, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. The Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings be upon him, was the last of a long series of messengers. And these prophets and messengers came to every nation and every tribe. They came to bring the people out of the belief in many gods to the unity of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, creator of the heavens and the earth. And it is reported that the prophets did not change the cultures of the people, but they brought them away to enjoy Tawheed, the oneness of God. And they brought them a Sharia, a law, that was suitable for their country, their people, and their time. And whatever was the means of income, however the people were able to benefit from the life of this world, continued within this belief in one God. The east coast of Africa was in touch with the Indian Ocean and the Red Sea long before the time of the Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings be upon him. And in the ancient Greek annals, an anonymous Greek traveler traveled down the Red Sea and into the East African coast. And he wrote Periplus of the Eritrean Sea. This was written in 50 AD, and it described the circumnavigation of the Indian Ocean. The ancient Egyptians also traded with East Africa, and they traded with dyed cloaks, tunics, copper, tin, and silver, and they traded for frankincense, ivory, and tortoise shells. The ancient Romans penetrated this region as well, and they called it Azania. The Himyarites, living in Yemen, in the southern part of Arabia, had a brisk trade going on with the people of East Africa between 155 BC and 300 AD. They traded in spices and perfumes, frankincense, myrrh, and they traded with the people and received gold, ostrich feathers, and other African products. And so this sets a foundation for the Islamic period. The trade routes were open. Sailors were going down the Red Sea into the East African coastline and then moving around the Indian Ocean and bringing together the cultures in Arabia, Africa, and India. So when the Islamic period came, the same movements of people benefited the movement of Islam as a way of life, and the cultures were affected, and the people were again brought together. And of course, when we look at the Islamic period in this region, we have to begin with Ethiopia, with Aksum al-Najashi, rahimahullah. The emperor of Aksum in Ethiopia had a powerful impact upon his people and those who were living in the region. And one could say that the effect of this emperor continued on not only just for a few months and years after his death, but it continued on for centuries. The first real report that we get of Muslims penetrating deep into the east coast of Africa is the Chronicle of Lamu. This was reported by the Khalifa Abdul Malik ibn Marwan of the Umayyads. He sent emissaries into East Africa in 696 AD. And it is reported that masajid, houses of worship, were built, and a connection was made between the people on the coastline and the Umayyad dynasty. Up until today, there are archaeological findings that people are gaining constantly, showing this connection. One of the most interesting is in Shanga, Lamu, the island of Lamu. And there within this set of islands is a mosque that is dated back to 780 AD. Following this, there's another report, and this is in a set called the Chronicle of Kilwa. And it reports about the journey of seven brothers from Shiraz. They entered into the East African coastline, and they succeeded in doing business with the people of the area. They even married the people of the area, and we know that Shiraz is in present-day Iran. So this connection is now coming about between the people of East Africa and not only Arabia, but also Persia. Following this, in the 10th century, our famous geographer and historian, Al-Mas'udi, in his Muruj al-Dhahab, he wrote somewhere around 945 AD. He wrote about trade that was going on between Africa, China, India, and the Gulf of Arabia. And he also wrote a very interesting point. He mentions for the first time in recorded history the presence of a language, and he called it a Zenj language. It was called Swahili. Following this, another famous geographer, well-known throughout the world, Al-Idrisi, looked at the world and he placed in East Africa Zanzibar and Muscat in Oman, and he wrote that this was a very powerful, important part of the world. Following this, there's another report, and this is in the journey of Ibn Battuta, Rahimahullah, the great traveler. And he went down into the East African coast. He visited Mogadishu in present-day Somalia. He visited Kilwa in Tanzania. And he recorded that the Emir of Kilwa was visited by a group of ulama, of scholars from the Hijaz, from Saudi Arabia. And they were known at that time as extremely pious and knowledgeable people. They were following the madhab, the school of thought of Imam Shafi, Rahimahullah, and they brought out the importance of Kilwa, and at that point, really, Kilwa reaches the height. Now, what we are getting from this is a blending that comes about. It is a blending of Arab culture and African culture and Persian culture and Indian culture, and what develops out of this is what is known as the people of As-Sawahil. In the Arabic language, sahil is a coastline. The plural would be sawahil. So what develops is a language, Kiswahili, that we would say in English, Swahili language. So sawahil becomes Swahili, the people of the coastlines. Kilwa becomes the center, becomes the base where the culture reaches its highest point. In the history of that region. And so Kiswahili is the language. Mswahili means the people of the coastline. What happens here is a beautiful blending between Bantu languages. These are Central African and East African languages. So the foundation of Swahili, the roots of the verbs and terminologies are Bantu roots, but the vocabularies are mostly Arabic vocabularies. So for instance, if they say imam in Arabic, they would say imamu in Swahili. If you say amir, they would say amiru in Swahili. So a Bantu base, Arabic vocabulary words. Also, there is a presence of Hindi and some Portuguese loan words that are coming also into the Swahili language. The next period coming in, and this is in the 15th century, it's after the formation of Swahili culture, after that beautiful blending is developed, and after Kilwa itself reaches a height in civilization, the Portuguese come into the region. We have understood that Vasco da Gama came in using maps from the Muslims. He also hired Ahmed bin Majid, who was a Muslim, to show him how to get into the Indian Ocean. And they came in with the pretext that they were fighting the Crusades. They came in with the understanding that by going around Africa in what they called the Cape of Good Hope, because they were hoping to get around the middle of the Muslim world, that they would be able to reach India without going through the lands of the Khilafat, through Turkey, through Iraq, through the center of the Muslim world. They wanted to circumvent this and go straight to India and to benefit from China and those regions. And so the Portuguese came into East Africa, and we find from this a period of destruction. They came, unfortunately, in the name of their religion, in the name of Jesus, the son of Mary, and they reached out their hands to the people and traded at first, and then they receded. They set up lighthouses and special marking points. And by 1505, they returned and they attacked the main cities in East Africa. Although they had found Kilwa as one of the most beautiful cities in the world, and they write in their memoirs that Kilwa and Mombasa and the cities of the East African coastline were more beautiful than anything they had in Portugal. But still, their intention was destruction. The people were Muslims, or Moros, as they would say. And so the same struggle, the same confrontation continued, and they began to destroy the ports using their technology, using their military skills that they had developed in their crusades and in their conquest of Al-Andalus. They were able to sack the city of Mombasa and to push the people into the interior. They also destroyed much of Kilwa, and they built forts to meet their boats at the shore. They built a fort also in Mombasa. They called it Fort Jesus. And they set up these military structures all over the coastline in Aden, in Hormuz, southern Arabia. They continued on into India, to Goa, in Gujarat. They made it all the way to Calcutta. And they set up a complex network in order to control that region. But this could not continue, because the people of the region were discontented by their rule and were upset at the way they came into their lives and destroyed what had taken centuries to build. Let us take a break and return to what happened to the East African coast after the period of the Portuguese. In the 17th century, the East African coastline and the Indian Ocean went through a major change. And that was that the Portuguese fleets, the power of the Portuguese, who had dominated the coastline, was diminished by the coming of the British. Not only this, but also a combined force of the local people of East Africa, along with a new group entering into the scene, the Umanis, coming from the southern part of Arabia, were able to defeat the Portuguese and drive them from all of their forts. When we look at the effect of Portuguese culture, we find that it had almost no impact in the language. There are very few Portuguese words being used. All that is left are a few forts that are abandoned or being used along the coastline. From this period, we then find that the Umanis, who originally came in to assist their Muslim brethren against these crusader forces, that the Umanis then start to dominate the region. And by 1812, we find that the Sultan Sayyid Said comes into the area, and he stops fighting, which is going on between Mombasa and Lamu. And then by 1840, he subdues the whole Swahili coast. And the Umanis then move their capital from Oman, from Muscat, they move it then down into Zanzibar. So the island of Zanzibar, off the coast of what is now known as Tanzania, becomes the capital of the Umani Empire. Huge plantations were developed, and slave labor was being used to grow the spices and the sugar and the different products, which were being sold all throughout the Muslim world. This is a sad period for Swahili history, because it is during that period that slavery comes into the forefront, and hundreds and thousands of people were taken from the interior and were sold in slave markets in Zanzibar and then also in other parts of the Muslim world. It is important to understand, number one, that slavery was not the beginning of Swahili culture. That Swahili culture really was developed from an ancient trade that was going on between the people of the north and the people of the East African coastline, those who were moving all around the Indian Ocean. Swahili culture was a beautiful blending of African languages, African culture, and Arab culture and Persian culture. But what happened during the Umani period was, in a sense, another form of imperialism. And so the problem we are facing today, looking at history, is that usually when people speak about East Africa, they speak about the Umanis and slavery as though this is the only contribution that East Africa has made to history. The reality is, this was a short period of time. And the first generation of Umanis who came into this region were actually freedom fighters, and they helped the local people to liberate themselves. To add to this, some new interesting information is now coming into the arena. And we want to open up these gems, this hidden history, and bring it out to the world. It is well known, as we have mentioned earlier, that the Arabs from the first century AD penetrated deep into the East African coastline. What is not so well known is that they actually made it deep into the south, and they reached below Tanzania, and they were trading, of course, using iron and glassware, and they were getting ivory and rhinoceros horns. Al-Mas'udi actually wrote about merchants coming from southern Arabia who sailed down to what is now known as Cape Delgado province in northern Mozambique. And so they had reached deep into the south. What we recognize now is that, number one, what we know as Mozambique during the Islamic period came from the colony of Musa ibn Baig. So Musa ibn Baig becomes Mozambique. Yusuf Ali becomes Sofala. And Sofala develops into one of the important cities on the East African coastline, deep south. It is also known as Sofala the Golden. By 511 AD, a traveler named Antonio Fernandez traveled along a well-worn trade route from Sofala to what is now known as Zimbabwe. And he trades with and interacts with King Chitaka of Zimbabwe. The indigenous people within that region had developed a very high culture. And what is coming out now is that the Arabs were actually writing about this. And when they spoke about the indigenous people, they gave a general name. They also used Zenj as a name. But the actual names which are coming to the surface are Vatsonga, Varhonga, Wakarenga, Waremba, and different groupings that are part of South Africa today. One of the groups, especially Waremba, they are described as people of a ruddy complexion who spoke a language similar to the Moors, and they wore linen and cotton, and they all wore caps on their heads. And so what develops here in this part of the world is a culture that is based upon the movement coming from the coastline into the interior, the great Zimbabwe, and this is where gold was being mined. And so the southern African gold was coming out in large quantities, and between the 14th to the 16th century, trade centers were set up all along between Mozambique and the Zimbabwe plateau. So that we see within the 14th to the 16th century, the great Zimbabwe is built, a massive structure there in Africa. And some people said it was built by non-Africans. This is not the truth. It was African people who built it. But it was as a result of the trade going on from the coast into the interior. What we also recognize is that the regions being passed through by the merchants who are leaving Sofala and then going into the great Zimbabwe include what is now known as Limpopo Province, also Mpumalanga Province. And these two provinces are important regions within South Africa. South Africa now has come to the forefront as one of the leading powers in the Southern Hemisphere. On the African continent, South Africa sets the trends for economic development, for political unity of the people. And Muslims had entered into South Africa from an early time and had influenced the people in that region. We are now also finding, because of recent studies and interaction with the people in that region, that there are tribes that we find with Arabic names. So we find tribes with the name, for instance, Salim. We find the word Basha being used as a tribal name in the south. And when our historians and our contacts went into the regions and talked to the people, they knew that they had Arabic names. They related to their history as being not the same as people who were unaffected, you know, by the Arab Swahili culture of the coast. But their history was lost. What is important coming out of this discussion and understanding is that Islam was not and is not a new religion in Southern Africa. But Muslims have played an important role in the economy of that region for the past few centuries. Muslims also have clear roots in South Africa and in the southern region long before the coming of the Dutch colonial people and then the British forces who set up the present-day South Africa, Rhodesia, and the countries that we know of the south. This is important for national identity. This is important for the connection between the people of South Africa and the Muslim world, that Islam was actually part of the culture. You take it a step further and you find within the culture of the people, Waremba, and down into the Zulu and the Sotho, you find Tawheed, the belief in one God. You find that many of the concepts that Muslims use were actually practiced by the people in the southern region. We find that people in South Africa, it is a common practice amongst the people that when a person dies, that they bury that person in cloth, in white cloth. They bury that person straight into the earth. There is a natural separation between the males and the females in social gatherings, in the household, and within the society itself. Also, many of the people of the South have a great respect for those who cover their bodies and are very much concerned with the virginity of their daughters. And many of the aspects within Islamic culture are found in the people of the South. This then confirms to us the presence of Islam from an early age and the fact that Muslims are not a foreign force coming into the region. But Muslims had something to give to East Africa, and this example is an example that should be taken as a lesson to the world. The example of the Swahilis. These are people now who come in contact with each other. There are African people living in the eastern part of Africa. They are coming into contact with the Arabs who are moving along the coastline. Instead of living in conflict, they intermarry with each other. They share their vocabularies. They share their food. They share their cultures. So those aspects of East African culture that were important, the medicines and how to live within that region, was taken in by the Arab Muslims who came to the coastline. Those aspects of high culture, where Muslims had made great progress in science and technology, and also in different household goods. And so there you see the Arabic language coming in, and Arabic loan words developing within Swahili culture, until a blending comes about and the Swahilis are able to relate to their African parents, African predecessors, and their Arab predecessors. And that is a beautiful lesson to the world today, that we are all part of one human family, and that we need to learn to share with each other, to blend our cultures, and to look at other races and ethnic groups, not in a negative way, but take the best from other people and integrate, come together within a world culture that can reach the heights of civilization. This is the story of the Swahilis. This is the story of how this culture even reached present-day South Africa, another gem of wisdom of the untold stories of world history. I leave you with this thought. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.